All right, what I would like to do is try to make the bridge between the material that we've been studying and the material that we're going to be studying. We're making the transition from the ancient world to the modern period. And remember that in philosophy and also in world history, the concept of the modern is a little counterintuitive, because generally when people use this word, what they mean by it is contemporary, as though what is modern is what is up to date. And in fact, the word modern actually does have that connotation. But in the history of philosophy, and as I said, also in world history, the word modern applies to the period that begins, and I think it makes sense to start it at about, 1450. 1450 marks the great voyages of discovery. Also the Renaissance, by the way, the tail end of the Renaissance. The great voyages of discovery, which through which Europe expanded into Africa, Latin America, South America, and then ultimately North America, and then Asia. Yes?
If we didn't have the age of discovery, would we be in the modern sense we were?
I don't think so. I don't know what would have happened. I mean, history has many possible paths that it can travel. You know, it's not predetermined. That doesn't mean that anything in the world can happen at any particular time.
Well, I know that the only reason why they voyaged off is because of the Ottoman Empire cut off trade with Europe and made it harder, so they had to look for alternative routes.
Yeah, and Europe was looking for gold. You know, I mean,
right.
Quite clear that was the at least the motivation behind the Spanish ships that made it to the Americas, but Europe, remember, faced a tremendous problem, and the problem was a result of the fact that about a third of its population had died out by this time as a result of the Black Plague, which was a tremendous disaster, probably the greatest disaster in the history of the Western world. And it lies pretty far back, but nonetheless, it's been unrivaled since. Even the First World War and the Second World War did not kill off as large a percentage of the European population as the Black Plague did. And what seems to have happened is that the plague was a bacillus carried in by fleas. And the fleas infested the fur of rats. And it seems actually to have originated in China. There was, at this period in medieval history, some trade had been established with the Far East. And the rats boarded ships that were laden with goods that were being taken. Pardon me? Yeah, maybe. I'm not sure. It may have had more than one rat. I don't know. But in any event, wherever the rats landed, the bacillus spread. And it spread from east to west until finally it had ravaged most of the European continent. And the conditions of the plague were horrendous. I mean, it was, you know, just a high level of suffering, respiratory difficulties, skin outbreaks, and it was terminal. And what happened was, since so many people were dying, and so many people were dying in the streets, there was a tremendous problem of contagion. It was very difficult to get anybody to clean up the bodies, the corpses, or to visit the beds of the sick. And what happened during the plague is what happened in many periods in European history, and even continues now. This was interpreted, once again, as the end of the world. You know, Europe was reconstructed after the fall of Rome with the expectation that the end of the world was around the corner. And that was built into the original Christian understanding of history. You know, Christ is crucified, and then very shortly, within a generation, it was expected that he would come the second time at the end of time. You know, the sky would roll up like a scroll, and we would be in the apocalyptic era, in which the world was essentially destined to be destroyed and replaced by the heavenly kingdom. But of course, that never happened. And then there was the widespread expectation that it was going to happen in 1,000, you know, the millennial year, right? 1,000 years after the original birth of Christ. No. You guys keep quiet. You know too much. I can't get a damn thing out.
I didn't have anything factual or useful today.
It was something useless?
Yes.
Oh, then say it by all means.
Well, Philip K. Dick has this theory that we're all really in 50 AD right now.
Yes, I know. I know. I know. Philip K. Dick is a fantastic science fiction writer, my favorite. He lived in Berkeley in the 60s, and he was also a paranoid schizophrenic. But that was complicated by the fact that he was a heavy abuser of psychedelic drugs. And one day, he answered his door. There was a knock on the door, and he answered the door, and what he saw at his door was a Roman soldier. And he felt that he was in a kind of time warp in which the history of the ancient Roman Empire was overlapping with contemporary American history. And he saw himself as a member of the Christian underground, trying to battle the oppressive power of Rome. And not only did he have this delusion, but he wrote three novels based on it. Because it gets weirder, by the way. This is a diversion, but it's an interesting one. It gets weirder. Dick began to feel that he was also under the influence, and this was related to the time warp, he was under the influence of a satellite that was in orbit around the Earth, and that came from, and he had alternative theories. He never settled on what was the truth. One theory was that it was a satellite placed in orbit by an extraterrestrial civilization. And the other theory was that the satellite was a kind of probe sent by God. And so Dick wrote three novels. Vallas was the first one in the trilogy, based on this delusion. And the novels are brilliant. I mean, I recommend them very highly. You probably have seen films based on Dick's short stories and books. Let's see, A Scanner Darkly was an excellent one with Woody Harrelson and Keanu Reeves. Why does anybody hire Keanu Reeves, by the way? He's so boring. He's so deadpan. You know, he never registers anything in his face. Yeah, he never ages. That's the other thing. Maybe he is just a product of the Matrix, as it turns out. But in any event, what else? Was Terminator Philip K. Dick based on Philip K. Dick? No. What am I thinking of? Another one was Schwarzenegger.
The one on Mars, I think.
The one on Mars, yeah. Whatever the hell the name of that one was. Yeah.
Total Recall.
Total Recall. Very good. And then there was one with Tom Cruise, which takes place. He's a cop, and he's able to see into the future because there are these...
Minority Report,
right. Those are all based on Philip K. Dick. My favorite science fiction movie, Blade Runner, was based on a Philip K. Dick novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And Blade Runner was interesting because somebody asked Philip K. Dick about the relationship between the novel and the movie. Dick is dead now. He's been dead for a while. But they asked him about the relationship between the novel and the movie, and Philip K. Dick replied, the novel has nothing to do with the movie. The movie is totally different. And the movie is much better. You know, it was the first time I ever heard an author praise a director and a scriptwriter for changing his novel so radically that it was unrecognizable to him, but better than the original, he said. So Blade Runner is really a fine film. But in any event, these scenarios, these end-of-the-world scenarios, which Dick often wrote about, were huge portions of Western culture for the period from, really, the rise of Christianity right down to the beginnings of the modern period. I mean, now they occur now and again, right? Y2K, but they're minimal. You know, they're minimal forces in the culture. They were major forces back then. And of course, when people saw this mass die out and the suffering that attended it, the suffering of the plague, it was natural for them to interpret this as the beginning of the last days, you know, the beginning of the end of the world. But of course, it wasn't. What it was, however, was the beginning of the end of medieval society. You know, the medieval society that had grown up in the wake of the fall of Rome was based on a couple of things. It was based on more or less the massive conversion of slavery into serfdom. You know, slaves are owned by their masters. Serfs are not owned by the lords of lands, but they are attached to the lands that the lord owns. They can't freely move off the land. And they have to work the land, and in the process of working the land, they remit usually about a third of their crops to the lord. And they also owe labor services to the lord. They have to work in his mill or repair roadways or whatnot. Well, it's a kind of servile labor, but it's a significant step up from slavery. And the reason why is that even though the serfs had to give a third of their produce, they got to keep two-thirds. I mean, a slave keeps nothing. And since they got to keep two-thirds of their produce, they had an incentive for increasing the productivity of their farms, an incentive that slaves never had. There are some historians who interpret actually the final fall of Rome as a result mainly of the bankruptcy of the slave system. Slavery is economically an inefficient system. And there are other historians, by the way, who interpret the Civil War and the end of slavery in the United States as a result of the economic bankruptcy of the slave system in the South, which could not, according to them, keep up with Northern free labor, you know, Northern industry. But whatever the truth is, the slave system died out after the barbarians from the North sacked Rome, and what rose up in its place was the serf system. You know, landed aristocrats with serfs attached to their land. And so that was one main element of the medieval world. A second main element was what you might want to call parcelized sovereignty. You know, we're used to thinking that our nation is run by a single government. And in fact, what defines nation states in part is that they're under the authority of a single government. But this wasn't true in medieval Europe. In medieval Europe, the power to rule legitimately, the political power to rule legitimately was split up between all sorts of groups. You know, the king certainly wielded significant power, but so did the pope, and often over the same territory. You know, so did the king's wife, you know, when she brought land in the form of dowry into the marriage. You know, so did local counts and so forth. And so what happened was you had a feudal hierarchy in which sovereignty was distributed from king to, from king to count, you know, from count to duke, from duke to lord. And each lower level owed its fealty, its allegiance to the next higher level. And that included, by the way, the necessity or the obligation to raise men in case of war. So there was no centralized army, but what there was if you were a king, you could expect the counts under you to marshal troops, and they could expect the dukes under them, and so on and so forth, to marshal troops.
Was this done intentionally, or was this done just by a product of the time?
It was a long, slow historical process, which I don't think anybody intended. Certainly nobody intended in the year 500. But partly what was happening here was that you had a mix, right? The Northern Europeans, who were tribespeople, Germans, you know, the Swedes and so forth, invaded Rome and sacked it. And then you had a kind of fusion between Northern European tribal culture and Roman culture. And the tribal culture was a culture in which chieftains had minor chieftains under them, which commanded men, who commanded men, and they had lower level chieftains under them. And so the chieftain structure kind of got imported into this new European society that arose, the society of the Middle Ages. Oh, by the way, the third major characteristic of medieval society was the universal dominance of the Catholic Church culturally. You know, there's been nothing like it. There was nothing like it before, and there's been nothing like it since. Even though medieval Europe was, in many cases, divided, and people who lived in villages certainly were often isolated from one another, they were all connected by the church. You know, the Church of Rome established churches in Northern Europe. They sent their evangelists north. They converted the pagans. They set up parishes. And everybody had some contact with the church. You were born in the church. You were married in the church. If you were lucky enough to have a church school, your kids might be schooled in the church school. And certainly as far as intellectual life was concerned, it all happened under the umbrella of the Catholic Church. As a matter of fact, the great revival of learning around 1100, 1200 occurred in the monasteries. You know, it was the monks who, for example, they were the publishing houses. The monasteries were the publishing houses. Monks very meticulously copied manuscripts, some of them very beautiful, by the way, you know, with marginal paintings. And you know, these are real works of art, the medieval illuminated manuscripts. But they also preserved what was left of Greek and Roman learning, some Aristotle, some Plato. And when Aristotle was rediscovered en masse, around 1200. It was the monasteries that published him, that translated him, and so forth. And eventually Catholic theology became a fusion between Aristotle's philosophy and the Christianity of the New Testament. St. Thomas Aquinas is probably the most important philosopher, theologian in the history of the church, performed that fusion of two different forces. Well, in any event, that culture, right? Serfdom on the land, parcel-wise sovereignty, you know, lords and minor lords and major lords and so forth, and the universal dominance of the Catholic Church together makes up the basic elements of medieval society. This is not a society with a market as you and I know it. I mean, certainly there are markets. There are local village markets. There are markets where goods are exchanged. But there's no market in land. You can't buy or sell land. And there's no market in labor. There's very little in the way of free wage labor. Either you're a serf attached to the land, or you are a medieval craftsman in the cities, and then your labor is governed by guilds that you are a member of. And so, for example, one of the things that the guilds did was it set wage rates. And so the wages were not determined by the bidding of employers, they were determined by the guild itself. And they also limited the number of workers who could be employed on jobs, which meant that big, you know, industrial factories could not develop, even if the technology had existed at that time, which it was beginning to in the late period. But in any event, you did not have a modern capitalist society with a global marketplace driven by competitive forces, or nation states that controlled the politics of the globe. Those are the two things that came into existence following 1450. Now, medieval society lasted for about 1,000 years before it became unsustainable any longer. And then it was in danger of perishing. What saved it, as I said, was the great voyages of discovery. And the reason why this saved it is that Europe simply could not survive any longer on the European continent. Declining population, people dying off on the land so that the economic base was declining, starvation breaking out, wars between lords fighting over a diminishing economic surplus and so forth. They just couldn't survive any longer. And so the voyages of discovery sort of broke out of that little enclave, which was likely to be the end of Europe, or at least the beginnings of a new Dark Ages. And so the expansion to America, the expansion to Africa, the expansion to Asia begins to develop a global market. You know, now economic activity is not just between people in Europe or with a little bit of outside trade. It's now occurring between four continents: Europe, the Americas, Asia, and Africa.
What would you consider a society to be in terms of social order, solidarity, and the marketplace?
Today, you said?
Yes, today.
Is there any solidarity?
Well, I mean, it's in terms of social order.
Yeah. Well, let me just make... I'll get to this, okay? It's a good question, actually. But let me get to it in the course of talking about the emergence of... The two things that define the modern period, quite clear to me anyway. One is a global market. Yeah, which means that labor and land is now saleable. Right? And we see this in the current period with a vengeance. I mean, labor is moving all across the world. This is what so-called illegal immigration is all about. You know, it's people seeking labor markets that can't sell their labor for a decent price in their own countries. But the global market emerges, and then slowly over the course of the next couple of hundred years, nation states emerge. Those are the two. That's the economic and the political dimension of the modern period. I guess the cultural dimension would have to be the end of Catholic dominance. You know, first with the Reformation, you get Protestantism challenging the Catholic Church. And then with the Enlightenment, you get more radical forms of challenge, agnostic and atheistic thought systems. And what is it that, that takes the place of the Catholic religion in the modern period? What's the dominant cultural force in the modern period? And don't tell me that it's cable television. What's the dominant cultural force in the modern period? Somebody else. Yes?
Politics?
Yeah, politics has always had a little place. As long as there's states, there's politics. But what is the... Think about it, right? What is all, where does the money go now? The money went to the church, right, in the middle, medieval period. People passed the collection plate and... Yes? But I'm talking about a cultural force now.
Media.
What is the science? Science came to replace Catholicism. I mean, think about it, right? Think about it. Even though the U.S. is probably the most religious of modern, so-called advanced modern society, when you take a look at the maybe Israel.
So-and-so.
Yeah?
I mean, 90% of people are actually secular, but those who are religious are, like, really religious.
And but aren't the religious Jews now dominant politically?
Politically, yes.
They are, because it's not separated. There's no separation of, like, religion and state, which really sucks.
Right. And that sort of flows from the fact that it's defined as a Jewish state, doesn't
right. it? Right. Because, like, for instance, my mom's not Jewish, but I grew up in Israel, and I had to serve in the army, but I can't get married in Israel.
Because
I'm not considered a Jew.
Because
I would have
to descent is calculated through the mother's line.
Right, and my dad's Jewish, so.
And your dad's Jewish. But you had to serve.
Yeah.
So military service is an obligation of all Israeli citizens?
Yeah.
Whether they're Jewish or not?
No, actually I think the Muslim citizens of Israel do some type of community service.
But they're exempted from service in the military.
Yep.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I wonder how that's
that works
the same.
Out.
Yeah. It's a tough one. I mean, yeah, it's an odd thing to require military service of you, but not to allow you to marry.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
So there are no non-Jewish marriages in Israel?
No. I mean, if I go to, my marriage is, not considered legal in Israel. Like, they don't acknowledge my marriage because I'm married here in Boston.
Right. Well, you got music out.
Right.
Get this address.
You're going to do it anyway. But.
Well, you got music out on a plane. You have dual citizenship? I asked you that in the hall.
Yeah.
Tell the class, do you have dual citizenship?
No, I have Israeli citizenship. I have an American, I have a green card. It's permanent residence, and I'm working on turning it into a citizenship. So.
Now, can you turn it into a citizenship? No, you can't turn it into a citizenship that's dual, right? You have to give up Israeli citizenship?
Oh, no. You can have one more with an Israeli. You can't have two more.
But from the vantage point of the U.S., you're allowed to have dual?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I know you can if you're born, if you're born in the States.
Really?
Then you're sort of raised abroad and you have citizenship. But I'm not sure.
Actually, my husband is a citizen. He was born here, but then he grew up in Israel.
Right, that's generally the scenario.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Some countries do rely to have dual citizenship.
I didn't know that the U.S., though, encouraged new immigrants or allowed new immigrants to redeem.
Well, it's not the U.S., it's the country that you came from.
Right.
If they allow you to have dual citizenship. So.
Right.
But some people acknowledge that.
Right.
Fact,
I think it's a little different now. When he was born, they were basically begging him to get a citizenship and begging his mom to become a citizen and, offering.
Right.
It's totally different now.
Right, and did he immigrate in the 1700s? That's when, actually it's interesting when you think about it, because the immigration problem is in the U.S. is the reverse of what it was when the Republic was first founded, right? When the U.S. was first founded, the government was dying to have people come. They had to settle it, what they thought of as an empty continent. And the American Indians were just sort of window dressing. Yeah.
Well, you say the immigration problem, this immigration crisis, so to speak, is largely self-serving. Many corporations benefit greatly from being able to hire illegal immigrants. Mitt Romney, who of course was immensely anti-immigrant, employed illegal Mexican immigrants as gardeners and house servants, and when he was caught.
Hey, that's what makes this country great. What, are you criticizing it? Go back to where you came from. If you don't like it here.
I wish I could. I wish.
In any event, science is clearly the dominant cultural force now. Look at the university, right? Where does the money go in universities now? It goes to building up science departments, you know, colleges of science. It's science that brings in the research money. It's science that you know, has the prestige. And this has been the case really, you know, it began around here, around 1500, around between 1500 and 1600. That's when you had Galileo and Copernicus and Kepler, you know, the originators of modern science. And it's continued right down to the modern period. And gradually, it has made religion into, if it hasn't abolished it, which it has more or less in Europe. You know, there's still churches in Europe and synagogues in Europe, but a very small percentage of the European population is involved with them. The U.S. is quite different. Even though the U.S., most Americans say that they believe in God and maybe attend church once a year or something like that, still, religion is a marginalized force when you compare it with the sciences.
Yeah. Interesting thing as well is, I guess, emergence or increase of patronage, where businesses are becoming wealthier or people are becoming wealthier, and it's replaced, because in the past the Catholic Church would give donations or support the role of research, for example, looking at the old texts to try to copy down old Roman and Greek texts.
Oh, sure, sure.
And just it's interesting, the reversal from a global entity to just private individuals becoming that role.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of truth in that. But in any event, my point is this. This is the formation that begins around 1450, and it's still ours. You know, the modern period starts about 500 years ago, and it continues down to the present. But there should be bells going off, right? The Roman Empire lasted 600 years. Medieval society, well, I mean, it doesn't really consolidate until about 800, so 800 to about 1500, you're talking about 700 years. You know, a whole new social system, a whole new cultural system, and so forth. Now we're in, you know, the 500th year, actually the 600th year, the sixth century, since the origins of the modern world. And the question is that going to persist much longer? And I think that all of the available evidence is that it is not. Now, I mean, I'm not an apocalyptic person. You know, I don't believe the end of the world is coming, or, you know, Y2K was a joke as far as I was concerned, and the Mayan stuff is ridiculous. But I do think that you can see real stresses and strains now in this configuration of forces that are probably irresolvable within the terms of the existing system. So that, for example, what this has required, what this configuration has required since its existence, remember we talked about this, has been the emergence of what in political science is called a global hegemon. Global hegemon is a nation state that dominates the global system. And this is in part a result of the fact that nation states are, you know, outwardly aggressive, and that they're willing to do whatever needs to be done in order to ensure the ascendancy of their own interests. But it's also a result of the fact that the system needs a global hegemon. It has proven to be impossible for it to sustain itself without a global hegemon. Because think about it, right? You've got a global market. Mm-hmm. And a global market requires a global political authority. You send out, think about it, you know, let's go back a little bit. You send your ships out on the open seas to trade. You know, they load up with goods in New York, and they're bound for London. Well, if pirates, you know, waylay them on routes, then you don't get to sustain global economic exchange. So what do you need? I mean, you need a political force that's able to defeat the pirates, right? That's just one example, one minor example, really. But you need a political force that's able to maintain order internationally, that's able to maintain some structure of international law or international economic agreements and so forth for the global market to exist, but there is no such global power in the modern world. Now, there is no such legitimate global power. There's no world government. There's no world government. What there is, I'll get to you in one second.
Yeah.
What there is a group of nation states that struggle with one another for dominance. And so the process of creating a global hegemon is one that's competitive and violent in character. Ultimately, because ultimately, who gets to be the hegemon is settled by force of arms. So what we've seen in this, in the history of the system, I jotted them down before, is we begin with Spain, and then Portugal as a minor associate of Spain, and these two are identical for these purposes, having global hegemony for about the first 100 years, about 1500 to 1600. Then Holland is able to become hegemonic. By the way, the nation that's hegemonic politically and militarily also is the economic powerhouse. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And you need great wealth, and you need more wealth than your competitors to sustain global dominance. And so Spain and Portugal is where the gold and silver flowed back from the Americas. Holland is the country that was able to build a huge fleet of merchant vessels and begin trading all over the world and accumulate wealth, great wealth, within the state of Holland itself. And then Holland is replaced by a battle that lasts for a while between France and England. And ultimately, that's won by England. And we get the British Empire. Right, the sun never sets on the British Empire. You get the British Empire as the dominant nation, the global hegemon. That's challenged by Germany, right? So then we get a Germany-England battle for global dominance. Both of them go down in that. Germany is defeated, but the British Empire saps the strength. You know, it uses up its national fortune, its imperial fortune, fighting off the Germans in two wars. It has to deal with devastation in England itself. It can't sustain its colonies. After the war, the colonies all become independent. And it's the U.S. that takes over the role of global hegemon around 1945. See, the point is that there is always some globally dominant power, but unlike the Roman Empire, in which it succeeded in unifying the whole of imperial Mediterranean and European and Asian, Middle Eastern society under the rule of Rome, in a relatively uncontested way. You know, there were uprisings and so forth, but Roman rule was remarkably stable for a long period of time. It's never been stable in the global system, in the modern global system. Whenever any nation achieves dominance, it's challenged by others. And what we see here is about a 100, 120 year period of in which nation states retain their dominance and then decline and are supplanted by competitors. Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't take your question earlier.
No, it's fine. I was going to ask, do you think the U.S. ever came to power? And you obviously do, came to power in 1945, but do you think we're losing it now?
Yeah.
And would you say China's coming up next?
No, I wouldn't say that the U.S. is losing it to China. Well, I would, yeah, yes. I mean,
economically,
let me rephrase this, yeah. Yeah. It's losing part of its power to China, part of its economic power to China. China is now growing much more rapidly than the United States. That's one indication. The second indication is that China is now a major creditor nation, and it holds the vast majority of U.S. debt in the form of federal bonds. Yeah.
But you also said that it's almost coming to a point in time where we're going to change the way things are done. Doesn't China already imply some socialistic views on its people?
China is a strange case. It's very, very hard to figure out exactly what China is and exactly what's happening in China. Because China is a country that is formally ruled by a communist government. And the Communist Party holds power in China. Actually, when you think about it, if you take that seriously, then the story that we've been told about the failure of communism in the 20th century turns out to be exactly wrong. It turns out, you know, if China is a communist country, then communism is the great success story of the 20th century. China is industrializing. It's emerging as a dominant nation. But, of course, there's a complication here. And the complication is that though China is ruled by a communist party. That party, for the past 30 years, has been implementing the most drastic free market reforms, probably in history. So what it's done is it's privatized the formerly collectively owned farms. It's put state factories up for sale. It's and by the way, in China, actually, the process is quite brutal because the Chinese state has never accepted its responsibility for maintaining social services. So under the old order, before the market reforms came in, the Chinese would get some kind of a pension, some kind of medical care from their local communal farm, one that they worked on, or from the factory, the state-owned factory that they worked in. But when these things were privatized, the Chinese lost pensions, they lost their pensions, and they lost their medical care. So now, Chinese families have got to pay their own, they've got to save for their own retirement. There's no social security, and they've got to buy their own medical care. There's no national health program. And so is it a communist country, or is it a, you know, sort of a very
informed
capitalist?
It's kind of like a mixture. I mean, that's what we're ultimately need. It's no one thing is right. It's some mixture, and I think China might have found, eventually that will have to be reformed as well, but I think it's more on a path of some things need to be regulated and other things can let flow freely.
Yeah. It certainly seems like the great success story on the current world scene. Yeah. Whether it sustains that much longer, I don't know. But Japan seemed that way too, 20 years ago. And then the Japanese, you know, economic structure more or less.
But is it really wrong to say to people, if you want to have a retirement fund, you need to save it yourself? If you're sick, you need to pay for it yourself? It's not really that wrong. It's just that we live in a society where everything's that stuff is paid for us. But China took a different approach, and they said, if you want money when you get older, save. Mm-hmm. No ifs, ands, or buts.
That's hardly what I would call communism, though. Communism generally takes care of its people. A socialistic government, I mean, one of the core tenets of it is that it's supposed to be paternal. It looks after its citizenry. Well, communism tends to resemble fascism more closely, to be honest.
The Soviets had a huge welfare state. As a matter of fact, in one respect, and China was like this before the market reforms, in one respect it was more advanced than any Western European welfare state, and that guaranteed people employment. You know, in the old Soviet Union, you had the right to a job. And the right to a job was effective. It just wasn't an unemployment issue. But there were all kinds of stresses and strains. In part as a result of that, in part as a result of other things. Yeah.
I have a question about, you mentioned what Colin, you mentioned that you needed, in order for superpower or global hegemonic power to form, you need an economic powerhouse and a military powerhouse. So what about with Poland? I'm not aware of them having a global military presence.
They did. They did. Their global military presence was their fleet.
Okay.
Yeah, they were a naval power, as, by the way, England was.
Yeah, I guess my main question was, is it possible to have only one but not the other?
Well, that's what I seriously doubt. You see, the problem is this. As far as I can see, the problem is this. The U.S. has clearly, by all accounts, everybody knows this, the U.S. has been weakened. And the Bush administration's war in Iraq was kind of a desperate attempt to reverse a process of slow decline. Don't get me wrong. You know, it's not like the U.S. is on the edge of collapse. It's not like the U.S. military capability is on the edge of collapse. It's not. But compared to the power and the influence that the U.S. had from 45 to, let's say, 80, now U.S. have military power and economic power in particular is simply not what it used to be. So the U.S. is a debtor nation. A tremendous amount of debt, most of it owned by China. It is a country in which wage rates are stagnant or declining and have been, really, for a number of years. There are I don't know how many, but there are a number of nations with higher standards of living than the United States. In other words, you know, the average wage. Pardon me?
Norway.
Yeah, Norway probably. Yeah, there are a bunch of them, actually. And the trajectory is downward, while countries like China, Brazil, to some extent India, their trajectory is upward. So that, and clearly, I mean, the stresses and strains are tremendous. The financial meltdown that resulted in this vast transfer of wealth from you and me to the financial companies and the banks, well, in a way, it had to happen. And if it hadn't happened, the banks would have collapsed and would have been all in deep trouble, right? But this tremendous siphoning of wealth has created a budget deficit that is going to mean less in the way of public services, you know, less money going to higher education, less money going to Social Security. But already the health, that minimal, really bad excuse for a health reform that Obama put together, already even that has been defeated. And so, and at the same time, of course, the U.S. has international military obligations that require the expenditure of a huge amount of money. But where is it coming from? Where is it going to come from? Like I said, Iraq was, I think, the Bush administration's last, or the U.S.'s really last desperate attempt to ensure its ascendancy in the 21st century simply through unilateral military means. And if you read, then the people who put together the Iraq policy were in something called the Foundation for a New American Century. This existed under the Clinton administration. It was a think tank for a political group that has now been called the neoconservatives, the neocons. Dick Cheney was in it, of course, became vice president. Donald Rumsfeld, who became Secretary of Defense. Paul Wolfowitz, who was the Undersecretary of Defense, who was responsible for the Iraq policy and ultimately for the invasion of Iraq, for drafting that plan. They were all members of the Foundation for the New American Century. And if you read their papers, this wasn't a conspiracy, it's totally open, right? If you read their papers, what they were saying before Bush Jr. came to power was the U.S. is slipping. How does the United States ensure its dominance in the 21st century? The foundation for a new American century. The 20th century was American, now the 21st century needs to be American. How does that happen? And what they said was, there's one card that the U.S. has to play. Its relative economic strength is on the decline as other nations' economic strength increases, but its military capability is unrivaled. And so what it needs to do is to go into a forward, aggressive posture militarily. And it was out of those papers that the idea of unilateral intervention, you know, going it alone, what the critics of Bush called cowboy diplomacy, came. And so when 9/11 happened, and actually there were also recommendations that the U.S. invade Iraq and that it complete the job that was uncompleted in the first Gulf War. Well, 9/11 happened, and now all of a sudden it became possible to get public support, first for an invasion of Afghanistan and then for an invasion of Iraq. The program of the foundation was put to the test. Its chief architects were already in the Bush administration in very high levels, and it failed. It failed miserably. Now it's being repeated in Afghanistan. The problem is, and this is the problem I think that it's a difficulty with the liberal critique of all of this, is that liberals suggest that, or they seem to think that the Iraq War was just an aberration. It was just one crazy president, one stupid, crazy Texan president who had gotten into office and who had thrown away all of the restraints. And if we just get him out, everything's going to be fine. What we've seen is that the war really was an attempt to answer the central conundrum, which is that the U.S. is declining internationally. And its failure doesn't leave an alternative. You know, what is there? So what we've seen is Obama fall back on, essentially, the Bush strategy, except he's not going it alone anymore. He's got 40 countries involved in the coalition in Afghanistan, each of which is contributing about 5 soldiers. Right? You know? Well, how does this play out? Is there going to be a recovery in the U.S.? Are unemployment rates going to recover? We're already in an economic recovery. Unemployment is stagnant at about 10%.
Yeah, some of it.
Yeah, where are people? I mean, all the predictions, even from conservatives, is that this is going to last at least another couple of years. Where are people going to get work? You know, where's the tax base going to come from? The U.S. has spent the last 30 years exporting manufacturing jobs, now exporting software jobs. Even if the economy recovers, where the hell are people going to work? And without working, of course, and without the credit that was available and that collapsed when the credit bubble burst, nobody is going to be able to buy the kinds of consumer goods they used to buy, which means that's going to undermine not just U.S. economic power, but Chinese economic power, because the Chinese sell to American consumers. Now, the U.S. is unable to control things militarily. Is China going to be able to do that? I don't think so. I don't even think China wants to do it. I think what we're seeing here, I think we're coming to the end. And I'll make the case a little bit more cogently next time. I think we're coming to an end of the modern world system. And what follows is an open question, but that's where I want to plug the Epicurean and the Stoic strategies. Remember the Epicurean strategy of political engagement with the purpose of moral reform. The Stoic strategy, the Epicurean strategy was withdrawal from the dominant system and the creation of alternative ways of living. So I'm going to look at those two in the contemporary context next time. What is today? Wednesday?
Yeah.
See you on Friday.